So who's picking up the bill for the wall again? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. As Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly was President Trump's point man on immigration. Now that Kelly's at the White House, there's some unfinished business for whoever's next at DHS.
Can the next secretary find a way to get not just Republican lawmakers, but also Democrats on board with the type of spending bill that would approve billions of dollars for a border wall? I think that's really a big question.
Yeah, because Mexico still says it's not paying. Also, why some American scientists are moving to Europe to do their research.
It used to be that European scientists would come to the U.S. for opportunities, but I think the tides are turning.
And it has to do with Trump's climate policies. Those stories and more today, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Sheriff Joe is now Perp Joe. That'd be Joe Arpaio, the former longtime sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona.
So last night in Phoenix, immigrant activists gathered in front of a huge balloon of Arpaio wearing a prison stripe uniform, and they were chanting in Spanish, and it roughly translates to Arpaio has fallen, or we took Arpaio down.
More about that guilty verdict for Arpaio in a moment. Immigrants' rights advocates should not be so quick to celebrate the conviction, because the man who was the spear for President Trump's hardline immigration policies at the Department of Homeland Security is now his chief of staff, John Kelly.
Kelly has really been the pilot for Trump's immigration agenda. He's someone who's been in charge of everything from getting construction going on the border wall with the prototypes that they're trying to build down there to the travel ban.
That's Ted Hessen, a reporter with Politico in Washington. I asked him to shortlist the next chief of DHS for us and what Trump will expect from his new secretary.
One person who's become a leading candidate is lawmaker Mike McCaul. He's a Republican from Texas, and he's the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. He's someone who understands border security, who has introduced several border security bills over the years, and he would come in as an advocate for DHS. He's someone who's familiar with the department.
Now, build the wall. It was a huge message that caught on like wildfire with Trump supporters. How much will Trump look to the next secretary to be the person who makes this wall happen? Will that be like their main credential as far as Trump sees it?
He certainly has not given up the idea of building the wall, despite what struggles there might have been. And I think the main obstacle right now is where the money will come from. I mean, during the campaign, it was Mexico's going to build the wall. Well, at this point, Mexico says they're not going to build it. Here on the Hill in Washington, D.C., Congress is saying that Mexico's not going to build it. So the question is, can the next secretary find a way to get not just Republican lawmakers, but also Democrats on board with the type of spending bill that would approve billions of dollars for a border wall? I think that's really a big question.
And is Mike McCaul, this Texas Republican, where does he stand on the wall?
I do think he is an advocate of border security, and actually a bill he put out last week, he framed it as a down payment for Trump's border wall. It would have devoted $10 billion to wall, fence, drones, a whole range of security measures over a four-year period.
So the acting secretary is Deputy Secretary Elaine Duke. What can you tell us about her?
Elaine Duke is known in the department as kind of a career manager, someone who's very accomplished in that role. And previously, she served during the end of the George W. Bush administration as what they called Undersecretary for Management. And she actually carried that role into the Obama administration. So at this point, she served under three presidents. She's not known as an ideologue. She's someone who appears to be flexible and able to work with different administrations. And I think potentially that could play to a strength here.
Is there any chance that she'll just be promoted to the job?
I think there is a chance. I mean, I think the pros in favor of that scenario are that clearly Secretary Kelly, or now Chief of Staff Kelly, he respects her. He wanted her for this position because of her experience with the department. I think if he has any say in what the decision is, he would certainly give her consideration for the secretary role. Now, that said, when you look at Trump's other cabinet nominees and people that he likes to have around him, he tends to like people with a high profile and an established reputation. And Elaine Duke, at least at the moment, is not necessarily someone with a brand here in Washington. And I think if she can maybe go out there and establish herself as more of a known entity in the next few weeks, then maybe she will have a better chance at landing this as a permanent position. They're not in a rush necessarily to fill this position. Congress is about to head out for its August recess. And that means that whoever is confirmed for this position, it probably won't happen until the fall. So there is some time to consider different candidates.
Ted Hessen with Politico speaking with us from Washington. Thanks very much, Ted, for your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, back now to Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He was convicted yesterday of contempt of court. Reporter Jude Joffe Block has been covering Arpaio for years. She's in Phoenix. So, Jude, just remind us, first of all, what was Arpaio on trial for?
Well, originally Arpaio was sued for racial profiling. The allegation was that his immigration crackdown in Maricopa County was unfairly targeting Latino drivers. As part of that case, in 2011, the judge said, wait a second, Arpaio, you don't have the authority to arrest immigrants just because they don't have legal status if they haven't committed another crime. And he ordered those kinds of immigration arrests to stop. However, Arpaio remained defiant. This is a clip from him talking to Univision in 2012 after that order came down.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to continue to enforce the laws. If they don't like what I'm doing, get the laws changed in Washington or in the state of Arizona.
Let me give you an
then
example,
I won't
for
be
instance.
Enforcing the law.
And so the judge in this criminal contempt case that started this summer ruled yesterday that Arpaio had willfully violated the order to stop making immigration arrests and found him guilty of criminal contempt of court.
I mean, Joe Arpaio is not without his supporters down there in the Southwest. What have you heard from them?
Well, really, Joe Arpaio has supporters all over the country. That's partly how he stayed such a relevant figure in politics for so long, was this national fundraising base. But he does have his supporters in Arizona. And I talked to his former chief deputy, who called the ruling a tragedy. He said that, you know, Arpaio didn't willfully violate any orders. And his lawyers say they're going to be appealing. They also think it's unfair that Arpaio didn't have this case decided by a jury of his peers.
Then there are the immigrants and immigrant advocates who've been speaking out against Arpaio and his tactics for years. What have you heard from them since the ruling?
So this is a vindication for many of the immigrants and activists who've been organizing against Arpaio for 10 years now. They feel like Arpaio tried to criminalize the immigrant community, and they felt all along and have been chanting all along that he's the real criminal. Now for him to be found guilty, for them, that felt like a real victory. You know, a lot of them want to see him get the maximum penalty, which would be 6 months in jail. But at the same time, some advocates are saying, you know, even a longer sentence probably wouldn't even be enough. This is Maria Castro, an organizer with the group Puente.
No matter what the sentencing is, will never be enough to repair the damages that he has caused in our communities. And for us, it's never been just about arresting Arpaio. It has been about liberating our communities. It's about reverting and retracting on the dehumanizing practices that he has implemented.
So, Jude, what do they want to happen next? I mean, liberating communities, that's a noble goal. How does that happen?
Well, they want to see the coordination between federal immigration agencies and local law enforcement stop. So they're upset because even though there's a new sheriff in Maricopa County, ICE still has a presence at the local jail, meaning that if an immigrant is booked into jail, they could still be turned over to ICE for deportation. They want to see that end. But that's a really complicated ask right now in this political climate, because at the same time, the Trump administration is really trying to beef up local federal partnerships on immigration enforcement, and it's threatening local communities that don't want to collaborate on immigration enforcement by withholding funding. And, you know, we just saw on the same exact day that Arpaio was convicted for criminal contempt, the federal government signed agreements with 18 sheriffs in Texas to coordinate immigration enforcement to work together in their local jails. So this is a debate that's going to keep going. But, you know, what happened in Maricopa County really is a cautionary tale of how this local level immigration enforcement could possibly go wrong.
That was reporter Jude Joffe Block in Phoenix. When an offshoot of al-Qaeda is driven out of its mountain strongholds, you'd think that'd be good news. But we're talking about the border area between Lebanon and Syria, and the victor in this case was Hezbollah, the Lebanese militant group that President Trump was taking to task last week. Hezbollah is listed as a terrorist group, not just by the U.S., but also by the Arab League and many Western countries. The World's Beirut correspondent Rich Hall was invited along on a press tour by Hezbollah to visit the newly captured territory. So this was not your usual media junket, Rich, and Hezbollah treated you and a bunch of other journalists to lunch. What did they want you to see exactly? Like, where were you?
Exactly. Yeah, this was a very unusual day for us journalists in Lebanon who cover Hezbollah, but rarely get the chance to meet them. They were taking us up into the mountainous area on the border between Lebanon and Syria to show us areas that they'd recently recaptured from Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the offshoot of al-Qaeda in Syria. And they took us to a number of positions in the area that they'd recaptured from them. And one of them was this underground cave complex where you could see the al-Qaeda fighters' possessions were still there. And we were given a PowerPoint presentation by a Hezbollah commander there about how the battle was won.
Wow, PowerPoint. So what is the message Hezbollah is trying to send to you and those other journalists?
So essentially, what they're trying to say is, we're called terrorists, we're labeled as terrorists, but here we are in Lebanon fighting the very terrorists that America is fighting in Syria as well. They say, we've captured these areas from al-Qaeda, and we're protecting Lebanon. We're an important part of Lebanon's defense.
You had a word with the Hezbollah spokesman, Mohammed Afif. What did he tell you?
That's right. I asked him specifically about Donald Trump's comments the other day when he praised Lebanon for being on the front lines against ISIS and al-Qaeda. This is what he told me. So some pointed words there to Donald Trump himself. He said, I think the current American president is ignorant of the region. And when he talks about battling terrorism, we are the force that fights terrorism while the U.S. continues to support terrorism in many forms.
So explain how he sees the U.S. as supporting terrorism. I don't understand that.
Well, I think Hezbollah sees U.S. support for Syrian rebels in Syria as part of a whole package of supporting the uprising against Bashar al-Assad. They don't distinguish between al-Qaeda and the moderate rebels and ISIS. Hezbollah see this all part of the same package.
Now, Hezbollah is backed by Iran, but like in Lebanon, how significant is it in its own right?
Well, I think this media trip was part and parcel of this question. They were trying to show the world that they are an important part of Lebanon's defense. They are protecting Lebanon from jihadists trying to come in from Syria. And they were sending a message to the world that, you know, we're an important part of this country and you can't separate us from Lebanon.
So one last question, Rich, because the growth of Hezbollah's power has gotten a lot of people in Israel quite nervous. What are you hearing about a possible new round of conflict between Israel and Hezbollah?
That's an interesting question because one of the only other recent trips they did, one of these other media trips, was down to the border, down to the Israeli border. And Hezbollah is very keen to let people know that they have grown stronger, not weaker, since they became involved in the Syrian civil war. They've got new weapons. They're prepared. You have to remember that Hezbollah was formed in the 1980s during the Lebanese civil war to kick Israel out of Lebanon. This is always on their mind. Many people see their involvement in the Syria war as a distraction, but it's actually related to their opposition to Israel. They need Assad in power to get weapons from Iran through Syria to Lebanon. So it's always on their mind, and it's definitely something that they are still talking about, and it's still fresh, and it's still a priority for them.
Rich, what is a catered Hezbollah lunch like?
Well, it was a very strange moment, actually, where we all sat down in this tent with these Hezbollah fighters. They fed us well, actually. They gave us chicken shawarma, and we had a nice salad to go with it. And it was a very long day, so it was very welcome at the time. But yeah, quite an odd moment to eat with those guys.
The World's Rich Hall in Beirut. Good to speak.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Up next, the French president wants to be dazzled by science, American science, on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The rap on Washington and the Trump administration these days is that nothing is getting done. Well, tell that to anyone concerned about the climate crisis. It's true, many of President Trump's legislative initiatives have gone nowhere in Congress, but Trump is delivering big time on his promises to gut the federal government's efforts to fight climate change, from pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement to proposing massive budget cuts to federal agencies that work on the problem. So what's someone who cares about climate change to do? Well, French President Emmanuel Macron has an answer. Come east, young men and women.
To all scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, responsible citizens who were disappointed by the decision of the President of the United States, I call on them, come and work here with us.
That's Macron the day after Trump's repudiation of the Paris Agreement. The French president went on to take a dig at Trump's campaign promise to make America great again.
Because wherever we live, whoever we are, we all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
Macron followed up this plea a few days later with a concrete offer, roughly $70 million to pay climate researchers to come work in France. So we've been wondering, how's that going? And is anyone taking him up on the offer? We called up a couple of people to talk about this. The first is our reporter in Paris, Adeline Sia. I asked her why Macron made the offer.
Well, I think he's trying to position himself. You know, he's new, he's young, and he's eager, and he's got a lot of support. So he's trying to position himself as a leader in Europe, and also certainly as a great patron of science. And it seems to address the scientists' community by saying, you are being disregarded in your own country, and come to France where you'll be treated like royalty.
I mean, he's positioning himself, but he's issued this invitation. So what do we know how this appeal to the scientists of the world would actually work?
I spoke to a French scientist here who works for the National Center for Scientific Research, which is going to be sorting out the applications. So far, there have been about 1,000 requests. Possibly 150 were qualified. About half of those were from the United States. And the website is very welcoming. You know, it promises scientists who want to come to France visas for their entire families, you know, free quality public schools. So that's all great. The only problem is that the government earlier this year announced a $350 million cut in a science budget. And so this project would cost about $70 million. And, you know, that has a lot of scientists scratching their heads and say, you know, where is this money going to be carved from? Not only that, but it seemed that no one at the CNRS was even warned about this project, much less so consulted. So that had a lot of scientists really miffed.
Yeah, I gather you spoke with one researcher, scientist, who is also pretty upset by this move.
Yes, I spoke to Patrick Montfort of the CNRS, and he's on the board of directors. And like I said, he was not notified of this project. So Patrick Montfort is saying, I would say to Americans, don't come to our country at any cost, because in the U.S., in spite of Trump's decisions, funding at universities are better than in France. So he says, you know, if you come to France, it's at your own risk. You may not like it.
Reporter Adeline Sia speaking with us from Paris. Thanks very much for telling us about this, Adele.
You're welcome, Marco.
So let's turn now to one of those American scientists who's looking to take French President Macron up on his offer. Ashley Ballantyne is an assistant professor of bioclimatology at the University of Montana. Professor Ballantyne, I've got to ask you, you've got a pretty sweet position already. You're on tenure track at a good U.S. college university. Are things really looking so grim for climate researchers under Donald Trump that you're willing to chuck that all away and head to France?
It's not that I'm running away from Donald Trump, but I'm certainly trying to diversify my research base and I'm always looking for opportunities to collaborate with scientists from around the world. And I think this is a pretty intriguing opportunity.
Diversify those ties and those connections because you're worried about what might happen further down the road under President Trump?
Yeah. I'm finding funding increasingly challenging to come by in the United States. So if another pot of money presents itself, then I'm willing to submit a proposal.
Now, your wife is French, I understand, so I imagine that might have made this opportunity even more attractive beyond looking for a more welcoming research environment. How much is your own personal connection to France driving some of this interest?
It's definitely enticing to me for professional and personal reasons. And then there's not as many personal obstacles for me as other researchers trying to assimilate to French culture and a French system, perhaps.
Well, as we just heard from reporter Adeline Sia in Paris, it seems that President Macron is also trying to stake out his position as a world leader, ignoring perhaps some French scientists who say the funding outlook there for them isn't so great. Are you concerned that maybe France isn't the promised land for climate research that Macron seems to be suggesting? Could there be buyer's remorse?
That remains to be seen. You know, these are four-year projects as proposed, so a lot can change in 4 years' time, as we know.
Yeah. Well, as you described your own kind of viewpoint, you're diversifying your portfolio. How would you gauge the mood of your colleagues here in the U.S. generally about the prospects for climate research under the Trump administration?
You know, I think the morale is, on one hand, a bit low, but on the other hand, it's in some ways galvanized the climate science community to speak out more. And maybe we were getting a little bit complacent with the previous administration.
Do you know of other climate researchers here in the States looking for more favorable places to do their work?
Yeah. So prior to this offer from Macron, I know of many mid-career scientists that have moved to Europe. So I think in some respects, there's been a bit of a reverse brain drain. It used to be that European scientists would come to the U.S. for opportunities, but I think the tides are turning. And there have been several really well-respected mid-career scientists leaving for institutions in Germany and Switzerland and France, England. So there has been a trickle of scientists leaving the U.S. for Europe.
Ashley Ballantyne, a professor of bioclimatology at the University of Montana, who's looking to take up Emmanuel Macron's offer on a move to France for researchers. Ashley, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Before we go to a break, we want to share something with you from our Across Women's Lives project. The team is in South Africa right now looking at HIV and young women there. The rate of new HIV infections in South Africa is nearly twice as high for women as men, and young women are especially at risk. This Saturday, we're partnering with MTV to host a Facebook Live from their studios in Johannesburg. We'll be taking your questions about teen pregnancy, contraception, and the risks of unprotected sex.
Like, from the age of 12, it's very common that children get pregnant, teenagers get pregnant.
Usually, teen pregnancy mostly affects girls. When it comes to taking responsibilities, it's usually the girls who do most of the work.
You can join us on our Across Women's Lives Facebook page on Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. News headlines are next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. South Bend, Indiana used to be an industrial city, home to a Studebaker car factory. When it shut down, the city suffered. Now South Bend is trying to reinvent itself, starting with that old factory.
I figure the reason this building's here is it's the one building that was so big that nobody could afford to blow it up.
That story still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, back with The World. It's a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've been telling you about a new project we have here called 50 States. We're visiting cities and towns around the country to hear how globalization is affecting you. And today, we head to South Bend, Indiana, population 101,000. The city was once a thriving center of industry, but 6 years ago, Newsweek listed South Bend as one of the top 10 dying cities in the U.S. Now the city's leaders are hoping to leave their history of manufacturing behind by literally rebuilding a piece of it. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
Go to a minor league baseball game to watch the South Bend Cubs play, and you'll get quite a view. Just across the street, a long six-story building with broken windows looms over the ball field. It's the old Studebaker factory, which stopped building cars in 1963. The cavernous factory is largely abandoned now, except for construction workers. I walk through with South Bend's mayor, Pete Buttigieg.
We think about the big three now, but we used to have a big four. Studebaker was a major, major American auto company. And we were kind of a company town for that. People know about us because of Notre Dame, but the truth is we really grew up around industry. I figure the reason this building's here is it's the one building that was so big that nobody could afford to blow it up.
Buttigieg isn't your typical Rust Belt mayor. He was elected at age 29. He's openly gay. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard, was a Rhodes Scholar, and served with the Navy in Afghanistan.
So I had to take a leave of absence from the mayor's office in order to serve.
Under his guidance, community leaders are looking to transform the old Studebaker plant into a center of high-tech innovation. They're calling it the Renaissance District. Shane Fimble's company is overseeing its construction.
To the left here, this is what we're calling the International Thought Institute.
Fimble imagines luring both high-tech and manufacturing here from across the globe.
And I think, you know, the simple message is South Bend's open for business. We have the infrastructure in place. We have the leadership and talent here. And it's really about how do we take our next material step forward and create the next platform for an innovative city.
why would they choose South Bend over Newton, Iowa, or Detroit, Michigan?
I think what you have here is a city in the middle of the United States that is just the right scale.
That's the mayor again. He says South Bend is small enough to test big ideas. Another advantage here, a lot of so-called dark fiber, essentially unused fiber optic cables. A major corridor travels from New York to Chicago, conveniently passing right under our feet.
We sit on one of the richest concentrations of fiber optic cable throughway in the country.
A good selling point. But lots of cities have similar selling points, says economist Dave Swenson at Iowa State University, adding some tension to the South Bend comeback story.
Every medium-sized city in the Midwest is chasing manufacturing jobs. It's a global economy. Everybody is competing as aggressively as they can. They're going to fight like the Dickens to maintain their positions.
South Bend says, okay, but they have another advantage. The University of Notre Dame is here.
Everybody knows what Notre Dame in Ireland is. I mean, the Fighting Irish and everything else.
Terry Fox runs the company Cutprint. They make paper cups.
Sounds boring. Paper cup manufacturing sounds like a boring thing.
But successful. He won a contest for entrepreneurs that connected him to Notre Dame. Then he decided to stay in South Bend. He's the Studebaker Building's first tenant.
I find in South Bend it's very easy to get things done. I mean, if access to the business community, very simply. I mean, I'm at this function tonight. In Chicago, it's just too big.
Fair enough. But in Chicago, entrepreneurs also have access to more opportunities, meaning investors. I had breakfast with Chris Murphy, the CEO of First Source Bank.
Two eggs over lightly.
I asked him, why would a hotshot tech guy, say from India, choose South Bend over Boston or the Silicon Valley? His message, Indiana is a lot more affordable.
That's attractive. And how do we get that out? We get it out one person at a time. I mean, the gentleman sitting across from me, Nitesh, he's attracted people from around the world here to be with him and his team. And you got to drag them into town. They're screaming coming in, and then they don't want to leave.
Gentleman across the table.
Nitesh Chawla. So I'm a professor of computer science at the University of Notre Dame. I'm also a founder of this company, Analytics, which is a data science software and solutions company.
Chawla, who is from Mumbai, had a choice of universities and jobs. He's a big fish here, though. He also liked the spirit in South Bend. For example, what they're trying to accomplish at the old Studebaker building.
It makes us believe and realize that, yes, South Bend was a center of this innovation and the center of automobile revolution back in the day. And then also makes us realize that if we don't keep innovating, it can all go away.
So we're in the cage of an elevator that was designed to hoist cars up and down.
That's Mayor Pete Buttigieg again. We get off on the sixth floor at the old car factory, a vast empty space the size of 1.5 football fields.
This was the beating heart of our entire region. And then one day in the 1960s, the last car rolled off the line and it was over.
Despite the boosterism, and there's a lot of it in South Bend, Buttigieg says they're not naive. He knows there won't be 30,000 people working at the old Studebaker campus. They're shooting for 3,500 within a decade. And he won't promise a return to the way things were. But he's tired of going to ball games and looking up at broken windows.
These are kind of our temples, these factories. And the question is, you know, are they destined to be empty, or are we going to harness the same kind of forces that brought them here and get them to the next level?
For the world, Jason Margolis, South Bend, Indiana.
We'd love for you to be a part of our 50 States project, so send us your story ideas about how globalization is affecting American communities, your American community. One way to do that, just tweet us using the hashtag 50 States. That's hashtag 50 States. It was only a few years back that a surge of people from Central America started arriving in these 50 states. At the U.S.-Mexico border, more than 100,000 people since 2014, mostly from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Many were women and children fleeing violence and poverty, and many petitioned for asylum. Those cases are now going through the courts, and a lot of those asylum seekers are getting deportation orders. Julia Preston is a contributing writer at the Marshall Project, which covers the U.S. criminal justice system. She's tracked how these migrants from Central America have had their cases handled over the past few years.
The Obama administration initially hoped to detain them and send them back quickly. And those efforts failed because the courts did not allow the Obama administration to detain children for a long period of time. So instead, the Obama administration released them and sent them out around the country to pursue their asylum claims in immigration courts.
Yeah, how easy was that?
This turned out to be a major crisis of representation. The asylum law is not favorable to the claims of these families. Many of them have very specific cases where they were threatened by criminal gangs. Their children were recruited. Their young daughters were threatened with sexual assault. But the asylum law in the United States is really focused on a more traditional kind of refugee coming from religious persecution or national persecution. And it was very hard for these families to make the case in immigration court without the assistance of a lawyer. And lawyers have been just very hard to find for many of these families.
Right. I mean, a lot of these families can't afford a lawyer, so they go for the pro bono ones. And I've heard that pro bono is essentially changed to low bono or no bono.
And in the court where I was looking at this, there's an additional difficulty for these families. The court that I visited was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and that's a court where two out of the three judges who have been hearing cases in that court really don't believe, and as a matter of law, that these families are eligible for asylum under the classic categories of asylum law. And so they've made it very difficult for the families, even with lawyers, to win those cases. And without a lawyer, you really have a very slim chance if you're a Central American family in the Charlotte court. But this has been discouraging to the immigration lawyers who do practice in the court. It's a kind of an ethical dilemma for these lawyers because many of them can't work for free. They have to charge, and an asylum case is a complicated case. And if you know at the outset from looking at the odds that your client has a very small chance of winning anyway, then what do you do? You know, many lawyers have chosen to be candid with people at the outset that they don't have a very good chance of winning. And so that combination of those factors has made it a very high rate of failure in those courts. And nationwide, 70% of the Central American family cases are ending in deportation orders issued in absentia. So the families get so discouraged about going to the court, or they have so little information about what they're supposed to do in the court, that their cases are ending because they're not showing up.
And when those families or those individuals don't show up for their asylum hearing, what happens?
The immigration judge issues a deportation order, what's called a final order of removal, in absentia. And that is the equivalent of an arrest warrant. That warrant is out there. It has the most recent address of the immigrants as part of the documentation. In the past, such an order had not necessarily led to quick deportation. But with the Trump administration, we have Immigration and Customs Enforcement much more active, much more aggressive, and with a much wider range of people who they are looking to deport. And so all of these families are now on the list of Immigration and Customs Enforcement to be deported.
That's Julia Preston with the Marshall Project. We have a link to her story, which was also published by The Washington Post, at PRI.org. Boxing, a sport for the ages or a violent holdover from medieval times? It's a debate for sure, but boxing also has long had a reputation for giving young people a way out of poverty perhaps, or just out of trouble. That's the cliche anyway. But for one young woman in Nairobi, Kenya, the sport provides protection, literally. Here's Wairimu Gatahi with that story.
Right in the middle of this busy and disorganized market in Muthurwa, a slum in Nairobi, is the Dallas Boxing Club. The outside walls of this old building are stained. A number of windows are broken, and there's no sign to identify it. Almost at the doorstep lay two drunk young men. Inside the boxing club is a different scenario. It's all energy and focus. I'm here to meet the only lady who works out at this gym. She's energetically boxing a worn-out red punching bag.
My name is Veronica Mbite, and I'm 21 years old. I started boxing about 4 years ago. I decided to learn because I wanted to be able to defend myself when boys bully me. You know, I have a small body, so people confuse that for being weak.
In slums like this one, bullying can be more than just verbal. Veronica says she has escaped numerous rape attempts when she was younger.
Ripka zote nimeescape rape sita.
Once our landlord tried to rape me. He was drunk. He put me in his bed and started removing my clothes. But luckily, my mom caught him in the act and saved me. The other one was by the landlord's son. I used to go to their house to watch cartoons because we didn't have a television. They were our neighbors. So one day, I was at their house. He grabbed me and attempted to rape me. I became scared and started screaming. He let go of me and I ran out. I didn't tell anyone.
Even though Veronica believes that boxing is a useful self-defense skill, she says many women don't have the patience to learn it.
Many women who came here don't understand that learning boxing is a process. They want to learn everything in one session. They don't understand that each technique, like the jab, uppercut, and so on, requires time to learn. Many of them give up when they realize that it takes time to learn how to box.
Boxing has been good to Veronica. These days, she feels more secure and confident in her environment. But her family has not always approved of her decision to box.
My name is Eunice Zibambithe, and I'm Veronica's mom.
Eunice works at this hair salon, not too far from the Dallas boxing gym.
Mi naona tu iko sawa kabisa.
Now I'm very okay with her boxing. At first I used to refuse her to do it, but her determination changed my mind. At some point I started attending matches, and I was pleased to see other young people also boxing. This made me accept that it was not a bad thing to do. Boxing has made her very focused in life. Many girls in this area are now single mothers and struggling due to lack of focus, but she's concentrating on her goal to become a boxer.
But she also knows it's not so practical for her daughter to take up boxing as a full-time job because there is no money in it.
Often you will find she wants to do something, but she doesn't have the money, and at this gym they get nothing.
Nothing in terms of money, perhaps. But for Veronica, like many other youth in this slum, boxing is helping her face life's challenges positively. Charles Mukula is a coach at this gym.
Many youth here end up being thieves, getting into drugs and alcohol like those young men you saw outside there. So boxing helps to keep them away from these vices. When someone comes here for training, their energy is channeled in the right direction. By the time they're done training, they just go home, eat, and sleep.
Dear Heavenly Father, we humble ourselves before you, mighty Lord. We thank you for the gift of life that you've given unto us, almighty Father.
Today's workout is done. Veronica and her team members conclude with a prayer. Tomorrow, they will be back to do what helps them keep focused, boxing. For the world, Wairimu Gitahi, Nairobi.
Forget the seven deadly sins. In the universe of Trump, there is a single grievous deed that rises to the top of the list, and that's leaking. Talking out of school, so to speak, is strictly verboten in the inner circle of the Trump administration, but it just keeps on happening.
You know, ultimately, we're able to work with everyone. We're able to get the Israelis to take down.
That's a recording of Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and close advisor. He was speaking to a group of congressional interns on Monday. They were told not to record the Q&A with Kushner, but someone did, and the audio ended up in the hands of a reporter at Wired. Kushner is someone who's rarely heard in public, even though he's one of Trump's main point people on Mideast politics. So his comments about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have gotten some attention. Here's the world's Matthew Bell.
Kushner was asked how he plans to negotiate peace between the Israelis and Palestinians and what the Trump administration can add that's unique. Kushner spoke for about 7 minutes, and all in all, veteran Middle East watcher Hussein Ibish says his statement was
not very encouraging.
Ibish is with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington.
It reads like a young man who really lacks any kind of detailed or nuanced background.
At one point, Kushner said, not a whole lot has been accomplished over the last 40 or 50 years. And he's got a point there, says Hussein Ibish, because in fact, the peace process has never actually delivered a final deal. But Ibish says if the Trump administration really believes U.S. involvement in Middle East peace efforts is useless, well, that's a problem, because Palestinians in particular saw some real signs for optimism at the start of Trump's term.
Trump comes in and makes this an important agenda item. That means the Palestinian issue is suddenly back on the international and the regional stage. And President Abbas is in the White House, and Trump is visiting Ramallah, and it puts the spotlight back on the Palestinians. It resurrects them.
There are signs that patience is running out. Today, a top Palestinian official accused the White House of abandoning the two-state solution. In the last couple of weeks, another wave of protest and violence erupted in Jerusalem's Old City. The Israelis are having fresh doubts about the Trump administration, too, says Daniel Kurtzer. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Israel. When I asked him about the president's son-in-law's comment that there might be no solution to this conflict, Kurtzer said it's worrisome.
To be charitable, it could mean that he hasn't come up with one yet or doesn't believe that the parties have one. But it also could be the beginning, you know, laying the groundwork of an exit strategy, you know, where you report to the American people a few months from now or 6 months from now that, you know, we've tried and the parties simply don't have a solution and we're going to focus on other things.
If it's the latter, Kurtzer says, preparing for inevitable failure seems like a strange way to rally the two sides around the cause of peace. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
We end today with a riddle of sorts. A man with roots in Sierra Leone, but who is born and grows up in the U.S. If he creates music that also has roots in the sounds of Sierra Leone, is it still cultural appropriation? Even if a legendary Sierra Leonean roots musician gladly collaborates with him. The duo I'm talking about is DJ Chief Boima and accompanying him from Freetown, Sierra Leone, Sori Kondi. Sori is blind and plays a thumb piano called the Kondi.
What's happening? He's playing in a village.
In his village.
That's Sori Kondi talking about where he plays Kondi back home, and DJ Chief Boima is translating from Sierra Leonean Creole.
So he started in his village and then he moved to Freetown, and when he was in Freetown he was a street performer and he would travel around the country to different cities like Makeni, Kenema, and he would play perform for people in public.
Together, DJ Chief Boima and Sori Kondi are known as Kondi Band. It's a millennial teaming up with an elder statesman. It's electronic 21st century music meeting acoustic traditional. And yeah, it really works.
Baby, hey, baby. Baby, hey, baby. Hey, baby, hey, baby. Hey, baby, hey, baby. That's it, that's your service.
When I first started working with the sounds that we recorded, you know, I just laid down a beat. The records are really just him playing, very little editing on the Kondi. Some of it is sequencing, but, you know, he's live. It's unbelievable how fast his thumbs move. So he's definitely able to fit into what we're doing. To me, it's logical in the looping. It's logical in the building of layers and the building of volume on top of different sounds.
Yeah, I hear that in the music. It feels very organic and very cool, like down-tempo sounds you'd hear at a really hip after party. I'm imagining a lot of hipsters are listening, but do they know this music has its roots in Detroit and Milwaukee and in some really cool West African musical culture?
I hope so. I think there's been other debates about this kind of stuff. I hope we can provide, our own perspective on that.
It's funny because I know that, Boima, you got into a kind of a furor a few years ago with DJ Diplo over cultural appropriation. Do you feel as a Sierra Leonean who's grown up in the United States that there's a bit of cultural appropriation going on here?
Culture to me is something that's very malleable. And I think that... I think a lot of people try to say certain culture that comes from certain places is this one thing or this other thing. But I know that Freetown, the culture is a mix of all parts of the world, from the Caribbean and its foundings in Freetown, to the diverse ethnicities and nationalities that live there today. So the culture in Freetown is just as cosmopolitan as any of my experiences are. And I think really what, for me, the difference is that, and what I'm trying to wrestle with is the more kind of material issues between, you know, Sori and I, you know, his reality and my reality are very different. And so, you know, when we're touring, moving around the city is very different. He's never been to Europe. Things like riding trains are new in what I experience. So just trying to be aware of those type of issues, I think, is more important for us right now.
Do you think we'll see you and Sori Kondi and the Kondi Band over on the dance charts anytime soon? That'd be really cool.
Yeah, I hope so. Let's make it happen.
Happy to do our part. DJ Chief Boima of Kondi Band there. You also heard from Sori Kondi, who holds down the old world vibe in the music. We leave you today with more sounds from their new album, Salone. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios, I'm Marco Werman. I'll see you on the dance floor. I'll be the one with the thump piano.
PRI, Public Radio International.